You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I've got Grant Kemp. Grant, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So Grant is a principal at Triple Equity, which is out of, it's an investment company out of Dallas, Texas. He also is the owner of Texas Pride Lending, which when I first talked to him, I wasn't sure. I just assumed he was a lender, but he's actually got a really, really niche program where he's processing owner finance transactions to make sure that they're in compliance with Dodd-Frank, which him and I have actually been on the phone here for the last half an hour just because I'm so intrigued by your model. But before we get into that, Grant, maybe take us back. How did you get into real estate and become a full-time investor?
Well, you know, I always kind of wanted to be an investor coming up. It was just kind of that pipe dream at the end of the rainbow. I was working IT. I was doing basically automation for a stock company. And, you know, things led in such a way where I felt like God was leading me to leave that job and go into investing full-time at that point in time, which I kind of jumped into earlier. I mean, I literally had only done 3 deals at the time. I quit my job and decided to go full time with it. But I just came to that crossroads that said, hey, look, my full time job is getting in the way of what I could be doing with real estate investing. So I did quit, and I spent, you know, 2 or 3 months with stomach ulcers and wondering what the heck I just did to myself.
Yeah.
And then the ball started to roll and started making some key partnerships of reaching out to people who were successful in the industry. Partnering up with them, Scott Horn being the main person that I partnered up with to make everything happen, and just basically sought out who is the authority on what I want to do and how can I go, you know, become valuable to them. And so I bugged Scott forever until he finally brought me in for a meeting and left that meeting with keys to the building and an office and just kind of took it from there and worked literally 14-hour days. I worked for the first 18 to 20 months. 7 days a week, you know, showing houses on Christmas Day and that kind of thing, of just, you know, putting in the time for it to get the ball rolling. And then once that ball started going, you know, it's a snowball effect and everything just starts picking up and you kind of get this great incline of business once you've been doing it for a while. And that's kind of what led to here.
Interesting. So you actually partnered up with somebody that was already in real estate full time. And I guess Scott was he a principal at Triple Equity at the time?
No, actually, Triple Equity is a company that we created together. Scott's been in the business for over 25 years. He's pushing 30 years in the business. He's a real estate and title attorney who's just a genius in the industry. I mean, he really is. Whenever I had closed my deals previously, I was looking for who, because I knew I was going to be doing owner financing at that point in time. And so I was looking for who the authority was on owner financing. Who do I close with? I interviewed pretty much every attorney that I could find in Texas. And then everybody kept bringing up Scott's name. So when I finally went to him and looked at his closing package and the contracts that he gives for it, I said, oh, finally, this guy gets it, right? And so that's where I closed my properties with before. So I knew just by pure reputation and by having closed with him before that he was the guy to talk to on this kind of stuff. And that's why whenever I quit, I just started bugging him.
Right. Again.
And it worked out. You know, I've been very blessed that he you know, brought me in, and he's been extremely, you know, he shares his knowledge openly and he's passionate about the business. And that's something that we can both share on that side of things. We both like diving into the legalities of everything and figuring out the ins and outs of this niche and how to use creativity to make money. And it's been a great partnership.
So how many years ago was that you left your IT job?
That was, I guess, a little over 3 years ago right now.
Gotcha.
So yeah, about 3 or 4 years. I can't exactly remember. I think it was 2012.
Gotcha. So you're working a full-time job and you were able to pull 3 deals together kind of on the side?
Yes.
And were those owner finance deals? What kind of transactions were those?
Well, the first deal that I did was actually my primary residence. I did the fabled buy a duplex, live in half, rent in half.
Nice. Yep.
And that, you know, that was great. I got an FHA loan for that. I still have that duplex. That's still where I live. We've had excellent tenants in there for the entire time. And so yeah, that was my first deal. Well, actually, my first owner finance deal came from one of my tenants who just had the classic story of you know, subject to. They literally tell me, hey, I'm just ready to let it go back to the bank. I'm just so done dealing with it. And I said, well, before you do that, let's see what we can do. Let's make let's make this work for everybody. So I purchased that house subject to, turn around, sold it on a wrap, made about $7,000 up front on the down payment, and that one cash flows about $350 a month. So that's, you know, it turned out to be a pretty sweet little deal. And then my next deal was the first one that actually came out of legitimately sending out marketing mailers. I used a guy named Jerry Puckett out of here in Dallas, who sends out marketing. That's his business model, is he sends out marketing for other people. Hmm. I got a lot of calls from that, and I took down another property with that. And it wasn't but probably 4 or 5 months after that, that I just said, you know what? I need to focus on real estate full time, rather than doing the IT job.
Sure. So you're in a very niche business, you know, in real estate investing, this whole owner finance thing and sub two deals. How did you decide this is what you want to do?
Because I knew I wanted to make money in real estate, and I knew I had no money to buy real estate.
Well, that's a good answer.
So I went out researching, and I said, there's got to, you know, my favorite thing has always been creative problem solving, you know, finding a solution to a puzzle that not everybody else is looking at. And, I got some very, just good leads from, actually, a matter of fact, the realtor that sold me my house, who has nothing to do with investing. Just, I called her one time saying, hey, I want to be an investor. What do I do? I mean, that's literally the level I was at whenever I started. And, she said, well, you know what, let me, you know, look into this guy. He goes and buys a lot of things from the auction and stuff. And that just kind of led me down a rabbit hole to where I've stumbled upon this subject to strategy. And I said, holy cow, that's it. That's the thing that's going to work. Because again, you don't buy houses, people give you houses, and then you turn around and you make a bunch of money on it. What's not to like, you know?
Well, yeah, you're using somebody else's money essentially to turn around and get money. I mean, it's a great
leverage
model.
Their financing that they've already put out there. You leverage that financing for your own gain. And a lot of times, you know, obviously you're giving them something, you know, you're giving them something that nobody else is able to give them. Most of the time, it's the fact that you're buying a house that nobody else will buy. But a lot of times, and those people that have higher equity and that kind of stuff, they're walking away from the table with cash in their pocket, whereas they wouldn't be walking away from the table with cash in their pocket if they sold retail, if they could even sell it retail.
That's right.
So there's a lot of it's a win-win-win. Somebody buys somebody sells their house that wouldn't have been able to sell it. I get to make some money in the middle, and somebody else gets to buy a house that wouldn't have otherwise been able to buy.
Well, I'm guessing there's probably a handful of listeners right now that are scratching their heads. What's a subject to, and how do you owner finance? So maybe just walk us through, what does it mean to subject to a deal?
So subject to is basically clipping out a section of this sentence that says, I will buy your house subject to the underlying lien staying in place as it is. Okay. So when you hear subject to, they're just taking that little bit out of that sentence, and that's what it means. In other words, what it means is, I'm going to buy your house. Essentially, I'm going to take over on payments, right? I'm going to continue to make those payments to Wells Fargo, who already has the mortgage in place with you, but I'm going to become the owner of the house. A lot of people feel like ownership of a house and ownership of the debt are one item, but it's actually tracked in two separate documents. You've got a note and you've got a deed of trust, all right? You've got a note and a warranty deed. Your note is what says, hey, I owe this bank this much money, right? The deed of trust is what they get in return as security for that. But then the warranty deed is what actually gives ownership of the property. So what we do is we approach these people that have problems with their property, with whatever that is, you know, that they're unable to make that payment for whatever reason. If they've, you know, it's a lot of times it's divorce, a lot of times it's getting transferred in their work, a lot of times it's a tired landlord, you know, whatever that is. And we will purchase the house. They will give us a deed to the property that says that Triple Equity is now the owner of the house. But what we don't do is we don't change anything about the mortgage, which says that Joe Schmo owes Wells Fargo $80,000 at 3%. My purchasing model says, look, I will buy your house, Joe Schmo. You will give me a deed to it that makes me the owner of the house. In return, I am going to make these payments for you. I'm going to pay Wells Fargo for you. And the seller in this scenario also gets a deed of trust that says, hey, if Grant and Triple Equity don't pay this payment like they said that they were going to pay it, I get to foreclose on them and get this property back. So the seller ultimately always has security in this transaction and always has that out to, you know, that says that if I don't say as I promised, or if I don't do as I promised I was going to do, then you get to foreclose on me, just like if you didn't pay Wells Fargo gets to foreclose on you.
So,
does that explain it?
Oh, absolutely. I think you explained it brilliantly. You know, this person that's maybe a little bit more educated on it is then going to ask the next question. Okay, you're transferring title. The note stays in place. What does the note say about transferring title? And they've heard the due on sale clause. And what does that mean?
Exactly. That's a great lead in. I'm glad that you bring that up, because due on sale clause is basically the one risk that a seller has in this transaction. Everything else is gravy and jelly beans, but you get the due on sale clause, and that's the one risk that they have. Now, what the due on sale clause says is that if you sell the property without the underlying lender's consent, that lender has the option, not the obligation, but the option to call the note due at any point in time going forward. In other words, that lender, if you sell the property, has the option to say, hey, you sold this property, I need to get paid off the rest of that $80,000 that I'm still owed. Okay, that's in every mortgage that exists. Now, originally that was put there so that, you know, when you're closing with a standard transaction, there's going to be a check for $80,000 sitting on the title company table. And the lender, your lender, needed something in writing that said that that check belonged to them, right? If you sell that house, they're supposed to get paid off. But again, it is an option. And out of the 10,000 properties that we've seen closed through this office over the past 25, 30 years, we've only ever had 3 due on sale clauses ever get called. Whenever there's a house that's getting the payment made, because at the end of the day, what does the bank really want?
They want to get paid.
They want their payments. They want their money, right?
Sure.
So if you're keeping those payments current in the real world, we don't see the due on sale clause get called. Now, it absolutely can get called. They absolutely have the option and the right to call that note due. And that's why it's so important to give proper disclosure to the seller up front and to give proper disclosure to your buyer that might be buying it from you with owner financing, because you want to do the right thing by everybody. If there's 3 parties that are all adults that know all of the risks and know exactly what's going on and still choose to move forward with the transaction, there's nothing wrong with that. If you, the investor, are trying to sweep some of these things under the carpet and just say, oh yeah, don't worry about due on sale clause, it's never going to happen, there's something wrong with that.
Sure.
Right? So
sure.
We're big on disclosure. We're big on making sure that everybody understands exactly what's going on. But at the end of the day, it really is a pretty small chance that anything's going to happen from it. And in those cases where something, you know, that where the due on sale clause has been called, Scott has been able to go in there and remedy that situation without anybody bringing money to the table. Again, that's not a guarantee of something that will happen in the future. We're just talking about historically speaking what we've seen. And never once has a due on sale clause turned into a foreclosure.
Interesting. I've always wondered the statistics on that, because you never hear of the due on sale clause ever being exercised, but I'm sure there is some small percentage where it's happened.
Oh, sure.
So,
well, I mean,
3 out of 10,000.
Yeah, 3 out of 10,000. That's a very minuscule amount. Now, granted, we've had more called. We've had about 4 more that we've seen called. But for example, you know, a couple of those were due to non-payment. So, you know, it's essentially just a foreclosure. You can't blame them at that point in time. Due on sale is quicker to go through with a foreclosure than standard foreclosure proceedings. Another time was an angry ex-wife who didn't care it was going to ruin her credit, but she wanted to call and get the husband's credit ruined. So she called them and said, you guys need to call this note due. They told me that that was your option and I want this. You know what I mean? So I can't really blame the bank and count that in a statistic, even though it has happened. So out of the ones where it literally was just the bank deciding to call the note due, unbeknownst to anybody, we've had about 3 of those happen.
Okay. Interesting. Well, the whole system is predicated on education, you being educated and then also educating a buyer and a seller.
Right.
So what does it look like when you're trying to educate a seller on, hey, this is the transaction I want to put together. Here's what it's going to look like. You have to give them just such a high level of comfort, I would think.
Oh, yeah. It's all about rapport in this business because, you know, you're building a long-term relationship with the seller. A wholesaler or a fix and flipper is going to know that seller for about a week.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
That's it. My sellers and I are on a relationship for the next 20 and 30 years. So, you know, they have to trust me as a person. They have to understand that I understand what I'm talking about. That's where a lot of, you know, my benefit to coming in and finding somebody who was successful in the business and had some credentials to throw around helped me a lot, because now all of a sudden I get that magical word of we've done 10,000 properties over this last 25 years. I haven't. I'd be the most prolific toddler investor you've ever met in your life. But sellers enjoy knowing that they're working with somebody who's not just some fly by night, you know, who's going out there and doing the best they can to learn all of the ins and outs. And, you know, the other side of that is just like with anything, you've got to know how to approach that pitch, for lack of a better words. When you're talking to your seller about due on sale clause, you're not going to say, oh yeah, due on sale clause is there, absolutely. They can totally call it at any point in time. And if they do, the worst case scenario is that you're going to have this house foreclosed on you. So sign here.
Yeah, right. Oh, say what?
Right, exactly. So y'all kind of heard a lot of my explanation of due on sale clause, and it makes sense. As long as you can make sense to the seller, they're happy with it. And the other side of it too, guys, is one of the, you know, because I bring in a lot of new investors. Last year I had about 55 investors that I brought in who wanted to learn this industry, and so I was training them and getting them going with it. One of the really common things that new investors do, and even old investors do, is they don't want to admit to the seller that they're going to make money on this. You know, there a lot of these guys are going out there, oh, I'm just doing this, I'm trying to help the community. Yeah, you know, whatever, I might make some money on it, but I'm trying to help you is what I'm trying to do. And a lot of times sellers see right through that. So I think that one of the things that has made me successful is the fact that I will tell the seller straight up, look, I am helping you, but I'm doing this because it puts food on my family's table. You know, yeah. I'm out here to make money, and I'm going to make money on it, but I'm also going to take care of a situation that's really rough for you right now, you know? And they kind of like that bluntness and building that rapport of just no nonsense, telling them when something's wrong, like due on sale clause, you know, telling them all the risks involved in it, but also weighing out fairly what their options are and what the benefits are to doing it in this manner. And you build that rapport and they're ready to go.
I'm sure they're going to ask, so how do I know that you made my payments? How do you handle that?
Right. So they will always have their name is still on the mortgage. They are still the owner of that mortgage. So they always have the opportunity to call. You know, you can call the automated system and it'll say your next payment of $867 is due on August 1st. You know what I mean? Like, so as long as we're making the payments, it's just going to say that the next payment is due that next month. Right. So that's one way that they have to look at it. Also, the online systems, they can always go online and check to make sure that it's been paid. If a seller requires, and by the way, I've never had this required by a seller, but it is a possibility that the seller could require you to use a third-party loan servicer, which really isn't a bad idea. You should, you know, as you're getting started out, especially as you're getting started out, you want to use a third-party loan servicer for all of your loan servicing needs anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things when you're getting started out in this business that as a response to that is you're going to say, hey, we use an entirely third-party loan servicing company. They're state licensed. They're insured and bonded to make sure you can always call that company. August REI is who we've used a lot out of the Dallas area. There's another one out of Washington whose name I can't remember right now. There's also Prime Loan Servicing down in Houston who is able to report to the credit bureaus with your buyer's payments. So that's a really good benefit for them. But that builds a lot of trust from your sellers too, saying, look, they're not paying me and me paying the bank. They're going to go pay some other company whose job is to pay your bank for you. You can always call that company and check on it.
So the loan servicer will actually make the payment as well, not just collect the payment from the end buyer.
That's correct. Your end buyer comes in and buys it with owner financing from you. They're going to pay that loan servicer every month. Every month that loan servicer is going to go out and pay the underlying lien and then deposit the remainder of the payment into your account as your cash flow. The loan servicer will also be responsible for collections of late payments, that kind of thing. Now, typically loan servicers are going to keep those collection fees, much like a property management company does with late fees.
Sure.
But that still, that's their, that kind of falls in their boat.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. So everything changed here in the last couple of years with Dodd-Frank. And so, you know, this seems like a taboo niche, you know, area of real estate investing. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an area that you've become, I guess, an expert in, which is how you've informed Texas Pride Lending. I guess talk to us a little bit about what the purpose of Texas Pride Lending is.
Well, Texas Pride Lending exists because there is so much misinformation out there and there's so little to help the average investor that's trying to get going in this business to stay compliant. So Texas Pride Lending is a mortgage brokerage. It's made up of RMLOs, stands for Residential Mortgage Loan Originator. I'm an RMLO, all my employees are RMLOs. But the reason I bring that up is because that's the buzzword that Dodd-Frank and SAFE Act and all those kinds of things are talking about. You need an RMLO to originate your loan for you. So what we do at Texas Pride Lending is we allow the investor to go out and focus on investing. We will focus on making that loan compliant. Right. So it's my job to know what Dodd-Frank says, what Truth in Lending says, what, you know, the SAFE Act says, all those kinds of things. That's my job. And I take care of that. And I make sure that whenever somebody, a buyer comes into our company to get processed, who's been sent here by an investor, that package is leaving as a QM or a qualified mortgage, which is kind of the golden standard of what Dodd-Frank has set in front of us that says, if you have a QM, we give you all kinds of court protections, right? Hmm. So as investors at our level, we fall under some very different rules than the big boys, the Bank of America's, the Wells Fargo's, those kinds of guys. It's actually surprisingly easy for us to have a qualified mortgage and get all of that, that added protection in court. However, you've got to know exactly what things you need to look for. You know, you've got to have certain things in your file. You've got to verify certain things a certain way. You have to have, you know, even if they have no credit, you have to have pulled a credit report and look at some kind of credit history for them. You know, a lot of our buyers, 90+% of our, well, I wouldn't, maybe not that much, but a lot of our buyers get paid in cash only, you know, and so they don't have pay stubs to bring in, and there are ways to verify their income that work with Dodd-Frank. So our job is to know all those ins and outs. You go out, you buy a house with owner financing, you sell a house with owner financing, you hand me the contract and you say, hey, Grant, you know, this guy's going to buy my house for me with owner financing. I want to sell it $100,000, $10,000 down and 8% over 30 years, make it compliant. And then Texas Pride Lending will take it from there and hand you a compliant file within 24 hours of when we've received it.
Now, it's not as straightforward as just saying, hey, I want to charge this percent interest and make the terms this, right? I mean, Dodd-Frank sort of outlines what you're able to do.
To a certain degree, yeah. And you know, and that's a pretty in-depth conversation there.
Yeah.
What I will say, just for the sake of time on this, is our interest rates are governed off of something called the APOR. It stands for the average prime offer rate. It works much like a ARM does, you know, mm-hmm. An adjustable rate, where you've got your, like, you know, they use the LIBOR or the Wall Street Prime, as the base number that they're working off of. And then you've got a margin that goes above that. Our guidelines work very similarly to that, except our, gosh, I'm forgetting the word for the base number there, the prime rate that we're running off of, the index. Our index is the APOR, which you can find at FFIEC, that's like Frank, IEC is in carry, .gov/rate spread. That will show you what the current APOR is. So if you look at what the current APOR is, which comes out every week on Tuesday, which is the average prime rate across America, and the government releases that for us. If you are selling your property as a first lien transaction, in other words, you purchased it entirely with cash, you have no underlying debt on this, and you're turning around and you're selling it to your owner financed buyer at that point in time, you now have a first lien transaction. Mm-hmm. My recommendation is that you stay below APOR plus 6.5. Okay. If you're doing a subordinate lien transaction, in other words, you buy subject to, or mm-hmm. you get a loan from your bank and you buy this house, and then you're turning around and doing a wrap mortgage to your end buyer, you actually get two more points. So it would be APOR plus 8.5 that I would recommend staying under. APOR right now, it's been hovering, you know, 3.5, 4, let's just say 4 for the sake of easy numbers here. That would mean that on a subordinate lien, on a wrap, you can go up to 12.5% interest.
Really? That's interesting. Because I feel like the information out there is a lot less than that. But that's...
Oh, yeah. It absolutely is. You hear people all the time saying, no, you can't charge more than 6%. You can't charge more than 8%. Well, it's because they skimmed the law and they saw 6% and saw 8%. What it is, it's APOR plus 6.5, APOR plus 8.5. Now, here's the other thing. You can go above that and still have a qualified mortgage. The only thing you can't pass is your state usury. Now, here in Texas, at 16.99, I don't know what it is in the other states, but, you know, usury is typically pretty high up there.
Sure.
So you've got basically two classifications of mortgages, right? If you stay where I said, APOR plus 6.5 and under, or APOR plus 8.5 and under, you're something called a higher priced mortgage, to be easy. There's a couple of more qualifications to that. Higher priced is what I like to stay in. I'm typically, when I sell my houses, they're all at 9.9, 10, 10.5, somewhere in there. If you go above that, you're now in what's called a high cost mortgage. And you can still have a QM that's a high cost mortgage. There's nothing wrong with that. However, just editorializing here, I feel like your protections in court are diminished even if you have done everything to have a qualified mortgage. I feel like you're going to do a little bit better in front of a judge if you say, look, Your Honor, you told me how I could charge 14% and still make this qualified. I didn't push that envelope. I stayed in the higher price market. I went below the highest thing that you were allowing me to do. I feel like you're going to gain a little bit more traction with them. On top of that, there's a couple of more qualifications that you have to do to have a QM that's high cost, which, as you come in and become a client of Texas Pride, we'll talk about those things and see if that's a risk that you want to take or not. But all that is a very long-winded answer to say there's a ton of misinformation out there on what you can and can't charge. Now, granted, when I'm talking about this APOR plus 6.5 and 8.5, we're comparing that to your APR of your new note, not to your note rate. So in other words, you may have a 30-year mortgage at 9%, but the APR of that mortgage is going to be 9.45 or 9.6 or something like that, because APR includes all the fees and all that kind of stuff that goes into it as well. The APR is the number you need to worry about when doing an owner-financed mortgage.
I gotcha. And again, not to get too deep into the weeds, are there limits on, I guess, balloons and when you can call these notes due?
Yeah, absolutely. So don't do any balloons anymore. There are some carve outs for who can do balloons. Again, I'll editorialize. I say, even if you can qualify for that carve out, don't do it, because the government has told us they don't like balloons. They're going away, I think next year entirely. So
really?
Again, I feel like your protections in court are diminished severely, at that point in time. And in order to qualify that, over half of your mortgages that you created in the last year had to be done in a HUD approved rural or underserved area, which most everybody's not going to qualify for that. But yeah, don't do balloons. If you wanted to do a balloon, do an adjustable rate instead, because the point of a balloon is to light the fire under somebody's rear to get them to refinance. Yep. That's what an arm will do. If their rate starts going up, they're going to get the fire lit under them, and you can still be completely compliant at that.
I got you.
No loan terms longer than 30 years. And, what else? No interest only, no negative amorts, stuff like that.
Right. So 30-year fixed, fully amortized type loans.
Right.
Another question. Really, Dodd-Frank's at the national level. Are there different states that have their own banking and finance regulations that might supersede Dodd-Frank?
Not that's going to supersede it, as far as I have seen. Now, I haven't looked at the other states closely enough to know. Now, what I do know is that I'm nationally licensed as an RMLO. To get that national license, there's a single uniform test that about 48 of the states comply with. So I believe I'm pretty comfortable in saying, especially in those 48 states, everything's going to be fairly uniform.
Okay.
Because of the fact that, like I said, we've got one test that covers all of those. There may be some things here and there. Whenever I work in other states, from the legal side, there's definitely going to be something that's different. And we always look to find who the Scott Horn is in that state and try and figure out what's going on with them, just so that we put our heads together on that first. But as far as Dodd-Frank is concerned, being that it is at the national level, being that I do have the license to work in those, I'm not overly concerned about state-specific things superseding the laws.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's get back to maybe the practical, investment side of this. I'd love to dissect the deal. I think it's probably a good segue into the best deal ever. I think that'll give folks an idea of what it looks like to get something subject to and then make money on it. So is there a particular deal maybe that's worth dissecting that would be your best deal ever?
One of my fun ones that I did last year was, or maybe it was the year before, but kind of was able to meld, mix and match some of the strategies, which I really like doing. Again, we spoke earlier on the phone, but I buy with every strategy. I do wholesaling. I do cash purchases. I do fix and flips. I do rentals. I do all of that stuff. Seller financing is the niche that I stay in out of choice now, because it's just the one you make the most money in.
Yep.
Flat out, in wholesaling, you might make $5,000. But I'm going to make that on a down payment plus some, and then I've also got cash flow, things like that that kind of add up to it. But one of my favorite deals was a deal that got brought to me actually by a wholesaler, and I've got to remember all the numbers now. But I think the guy owed 37 on the property to his bank. He was $8,000 behind in payments, so And he was being foreclosed on. He was going to get foreclosed on in within, I think, the next month was when the sale date was. The wholesaler that brought it to me wanted $5,000 for the deal. Mm-hmm. Okay. So out of my pocket, I only had to reach in and grab $12,000. Or I guess that's 13, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Right. Gotcha. 13.
But what was it? There was something else where I ended up having to pay about $15,000 out of pocket.
Okay.
Oh, that's what it was. I'm sorry. My numbers are all wrong now. I'm becoming more clear on it. The guy was $12,000 behind on payments, and I paid the guy $5,000 in an assignment fee. So I was out of pocket $17,000 total.
Gotcha.
Now my total basis in this property, if you include the back payments and you include the
wholesale fee.
Yep. You know, I'm in at about 45, right? Yep. 47 or something like that, because, you know, much of those payments were going to buy down principal and everything like that. When all was said and done, I was able to put that house out on MLS because we had some equity. It was worth 112.
Oh my gosh. Right? Holy cow.
And I have to take back another number of mine. I'm looking at my files now to try and remember this. They owed 45. I put 17 into it. So now I'm a little bit over 60 in my basis, right?
Gotcha. 62%. Yep. Okay.
So that's where I was acquiring it. The guy owed 45. He was 12 behind. I paid $5,000 in back payments. So out of my pocket, I was only out 17 grand. Well, it was worth 112. Well, I put it up on the MLS because the market was going a little. It was when it was right, just starting to go a little crazy. I put it on the MLS for 128.5 just to see. You know, I didn't fix anything in the property. I didn't go in and touch it at all. And a hedge fund approached me about it, and they said, "We'll pay you 115 for it." And which, hey, that's $3,000 more than the value that we pulled comp wise, right?
And sure.
Deal. Well, I replied back to him. I said, "Man, you're beating me up here. I've got it up for 128.5, and you're only coming at 115." I was like, "I'll do the deal if you'll buy it at 119." He goes, "Okay, I'll do it."
Nice.
So here we are with a total basis of 63 or so, and we were able to sell it for almost $120,000. When all was said and done, you know, I got a net cash profit of about $60,000, a little bit under on that deal. But it was because we understood how to buy a property subject to, right? Because we were able to buy it from the guy subject to, bring the money to bring his loan current so the bank was no longer going to foreclose on it, right? By marketing and using the tools around me, like other investors, like this wholesaler who brought me the deal. And this came because I go out and I let people know, hey, this is what I look for. This is what I buy. If people are really behind on payments, they got to move now. This is something that we can move with, right? So mixing all of those together. And then in this particular scenario, going out and listing it as a cash deal and getting cashed out for, you know, a nice little $60,000 check at the end of the day.
Without fixing it up, man. That's pretty solid.
I didn't lift a finger and it sold in 12 days.
You know, that I'm just curious, how many of the subject two deals that you buy, do you end up having to put some money into them before you turn around and owner finance them back out?
Pretty few. It's, you know, it kind of depends on the area and kind of depends on how messed up the house is and if I have room to price it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I'm putting money into a subject to house that I'm going to sell for a wrap, I'm typically usually only putting $3,000 to $5,000 in per property. Okay. You know, these are basic cosmetic things. I'm putting new carpet in. You know, I just got done over in a house in Fort Worth, sanding down and refinishing the hardwoods on this little, you know, it's a house that's got a $900 a month payment. It's a little, you know, 1950s build frame house. But when you walk into it, you know, I was able to get about $20,000 more on the purchase price because of putting new paint and refinishing the hardwoods and, you know, putting some new fans up that were a little bit nicer, just little things like that. You know, spent $5,400 on it and got $20,000 out of the sales price difference, you know.
And what's a typical down payment for you on something like that?
10%. You're always looking for 10%.
Wow.
I will get 10% one way or another from the buyer, whether I'm financing that to them or they're coming up with it all at once. And the buyer pays all of the closing costs for my acquisition and my sale.
So in some cases, you're putting up some money to fix up the house, and you're at least getting reimbursed from their down payment.
Yeah, absolutely. My goal, I'm happy if I'm at a net zero. Yeah. Purchasing a house up front, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I will run into one of basically four scenarios out of all the houses. Either I will be under by about $3,000, or I will be at a net zero, or I'm going to profit about $4,000 or $7,000 on the upfront. Those are kind of the most common numbers that I see coming through here. Because I pay out a lot of people for doing a lot of things. You know, I've got acquisitions guys, I've got sales guys, I've got the, you know, the rehab teams out there and all that kind of stuff. And just as a soapbox sidestep here, do not be afraid to pay other people for what they're good at. That's one of the biggest pieces of advice I can give to anybody listening to this. I've run into so many investors who are so afraid of what somebody else is going to make on their deal that they don't do the deal.
Yeah, it's crazy. The numbers, that's my exact philosophy. The numbers are the numbers. If they work, who cares if everybody else is making money? Even if they're making more than you, if you're still going to make good money on the deal, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's a good point. This is such an interesting business model, especially to scale it the way you have. And I guess you've got a team of people that you've trained and how to sell it and put it together. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely scratching my head because it's like you and I talked about earlier, folks that are out there marketing for just, you know, for cash deals. What would you say for every one cash deal that you've lead that you get that's worth buying? How many do you think you have that are potential subject to deals?
At least two, if not three. For every cash deal you actually buy out of that marketing campaign, you've passed up on at least two deals that you could have bought with seller financing.
That's so interesting. So somebody like me, and there's a lot of folks out there as well that probably have a pretty big database of motivated seller leads. I mean, it's worth it to go back into that list and just start calling back through them and see who, you know, who's open to doing the owner finance.
Well, I always tell people this, and feel free to steal it. I'm sure somebody out there will, but when you're talking to somebody in that method, you know, I'm huge into looking through those kinds of databases, because on that, you're going to pay for your marketing budget out of your trash can.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
You know?
Well, and then over time, you keep doing it consistently, you're going to create an incredible amount of equity in just these notes you've created and cash flow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy how much in these little deals that everybody passed up. Last year, for instance, I bought houses pretty much solely that were passed up by other. I think I only bought, I don't know. I don't have my statistics in front of me, but most of my houses had been turned down by a cash investor.
Yep.
And out of those houses that I bought last year, I got about $750,000-$800,000 worth of equity.
Unbelievable. And how many deals is that?
Right about 100, under 100. It was like 87 or something like that.
Okay. That's crazy. It's so, literally like just creating cash or equity out of thin air.
Yeah, that's one of the jokes that we'll make every so once in a while. What do you do for a living? Well, I print money.
Yeah, in contracts. I just create money out of nowhere.
I just decide that this is going to be what somebody owes me, and then they do.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, obviously that's very simplified and a joke. I mean, you're looking at comps. You're looking at what things are worth. But we're able to create equity in this industry that cash investors aren't able to do. And it's through knowing the ins and outs and knowing what you can and can't do and doing it ethically and correctly, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. So Texas Pride Lending, you guys are nationwide. So there's an investor out there that wants to do an owner finance deal. They can call you and you can typically keep them in compliance and handle the back end.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I'm licensed in about 48, I think, of the states now that comply with the national standards. So if you want to get in touch with us, if you're looking into doing some owner financing and you want to get involved with that, or you're already doing owner financing and you want to make sure that you're compliant, or for instance, I've got a lot of clients that come into me for the first time that say, "Holy cow, Grant, I didn't realize how bad I've been screwing this up for the past year." We can work with you to basically refinance those buyers that you've already messed up and put them into a compliant owner financed loan with you, so you're not fearful of what's going to happen in the future. Oh, but if any of those scenarios pop true for you, please get in touch with me. I mean, mail at texaspridelending.com is probably the best way to get in touch. That's going to hit me and all of my loan officers, so somebody will get back to you. And again, we have a 24-hour turnaround time from the point in time that you send us a file that needs to be in compliance to the time that you've got that compliant file in your inbox is 24 hours, and we charge $750 per file up until the laws change in October, when our job is going to become much more involved, and in that case, I'm raising the price by $100. But you charge that all to your buyer. We're big on not making you reach into your pocket for any kind of closing costs or anything like that, and charge those fees out to the buyer and stay compliant and not worried.
And it's a no-brainer. Yeah, if you're looking to do any sort of owner finance, even if it's a one-off, it's a no-brainer to team up with somebody like you that understands this. I think I mentioned earlier, I did an owner finance transaction a couple months ago, and there happened to be a guy here locally that, same thing, he charged about $700, charged it to my buyer, but I guarantee he was not as knowledgeable about the space as you guys are. So I guarantee my next one will be coming through Texas Pride Lending. What's the website?
TexasPrideLending.com.
Easy enough. TexasPrideLending.com. Grant, thanks so much for being on the show. This was fantastic.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ken.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right.
Hey, Deal Farm podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini with a special offer. If you go to our website right now, dealfarm.net, you have the ability to download our new blueprint. It's called 30 Days to 10K. It's basically the exact blueprint you need to start profiting from wholesaling real estate right now. It's the resources, it's the websites, it's the services that we use. I've even included my exact postcard that I send out. Basically everything you need to start getting deals in the next 30 days. Again, it's at our website, dealfarm.net. Check it out. You can download it for free. Also, we still have our free t-shirt offer. If you want a free Deal Farm podcast t-shirt, just subscribe through iTunes to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating, and then go through our website, contact us, give us your name, address, and t-shirt size, and we will send you a t-shirt in the mail immediately. As always, thanks so much for listening to the Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.